The Tom Woods Show, episode 2342.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. As the academic year winds down, it's time to start thinking about what you're going to do in the fall. And of course, I highly recommend the self-taught K through 12 Ron Paul curriculum. Not only will your kids get the real story about everything, but they'll also learn the kinds of practical things that they won't learn in the traditional school. For instance, how to be an effective public speaker, how to manage money, and how to run your own home business. And of course, when they reach the high school grades, they will be learning Western civilization and U.S. government from old Tom Woods here. But here's the most important thing. If you're going to join, make sure you join through my link, because only through my link do you get $160 worth of free bonuses. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. We're talking privacy today with our old friend Naomi Brockwell. And Naomi, every time I talk to you, I feel like you're up to something new and you've done so much already. You've been involved in so many things and you've accomplished so much. And now you have NBTV. Of course, I want to talk about your beginner's introduction to privacy, which is a great ebook I just finished reading. But in order to introduce you properly, I think I'm going to need your assistance. So what exactly are you up to these days?
I am really interested in finding ways to give people back sovereignty in their lives, in their digital lives in particular. So I think the last time we spoke, it was probably about 5 years ago, and it was all about cryptocurrency and about financial sovereignty and how to take back control of your money and not have to depend on third parties and all the ways you could use crypto in your daily life. But basically, a few years ago, I came to this realization that even if you have a decentralized tool like cryptocurrency that in theory can't be shut down by the government, which Bitcoin can't, and a lot of cryptocurrencies can't because they are decentralized, if you're not using them privately and the government doesn't want you to use it and they can identify that you're using it, then they can just target you as an individual. And I started to really realize how far we have descended into this Orwellian surveillance nightmare and how little people understood about how this data is collected and how vulnerable it makes all of us. If we ever want to speak out against government, if we ever want to be a dissident, go to a protest, be an activist, you know, do anything that is frowned upon or is not towing the mainstream line, we could be vulnerable because there is no way to really keep that activity safe online, or at least most people don't know how to do it. And so I was one of those people. And so I just kind of went down this rabbit hole, and I've been there for years now, deep in the rabbit hole, where I've just kind of been slowly learning about how all this data collection happens and learning about all of the tools that can help us reclaim our digital lives. Because the internet isn't meant to be like this. We shouldn't have normalized this surveillance that is so pervasive these days. And we really should be fighting back. And I want to change the narrative. I want people to fight back. I want people to use these alternative tools and realize that actually, yeah, they can carve out a private space in the digital world. And I think it's just so important for a free society that we do that and we recognize the importance of privacy in a free society.
I think some people have the attitude that I'm not doing anything wrong, so I have nothing to fear from surveillance. And if I may toot my own horn a bit, back around maybe 2012 or so, I think I testified before a congressional committee on behalf of the Audit the Fed bill. And I somewhat snarkily said to the Fed side of the argument, look, if you're not doing anything wrong and you have nothing to hide, then there's no problem, right? I tried to turn that argument back around on them that they use on us all the time. But what would you say to somebody who feels like, look, I'm just the average Joe using the internet for average purposes. I'm not trying to overthrow the government. I'm not trying to do anything illegal. So why should I worry? Even if they are spying on me, so what?
I have a lot of arguments for that. So first of all, I would say that as someone who believes in a free society, we should not be normalizing surveillance. You look at any dystopian sci-fi film, it always centers around the government having access to all of your activities. In every historical authoritarian government that we can point to throughout history, they've always had surveillance as a main tool for control. So you do not want to normalize a society where the government knows every single thing that's going on. The other thing is that we are all feeding this permanent treasure trove of information about us, and that data is forever. Now, you may not be doing anything wrong today, but regimes come and go. Social norms change. You don't know who will be in power tomorrow. And that data is forever. It is not going anywhere. It is in silos that is just permanently stored in databases all over the world that are just being maintained by people who love collecting data. So I would be really careful about thinking that just because you're safe today, that you're going to be safe tomorrow. And I would also say that that argument of I'm not doing anything wrong kind of flies in the face of what half the people in the world are facing. Not everyone is lucky enough to live in a semi-free country. Some people around the world are literally fighting for their lives, and privacy is the only tool that is keeping them safe. If they cannot have private communications with people, if they cannot find a way to mask their transactions, they are going to be persecuted. And that happens in so many countries, countries where the black market doesn't just refer to drugs or whatever else, you know, is on there. Maybe it applies to medicine. Maybe it applies to clothing. Maybe you've had too much of your food quota and you're trying to find something to feed your family. And so we have to realize that norms across the world vary so dramatically. And so this idea, when people are snarky about privacy and they're like, oh, you know, it's just something for bad people. Why do you want to hide your conversations? Why do you want to hide your money? Encryption is just a tool for the money launderers and the drug dealers or whatever else. It really is a very privileged position that they're talking from, right? Because this is a tool for freedom for so many people across the globe. Encrypted chat is a tool for freedom. Tor is a tool for freedom. Private money is a tool for freedom that is keeping people alive. And even if it weren't, I think it's the individual's right to keep their lives private. That's what the Fourth Amendment was made for. It was to stop unreasonable searches and seizures. And for some reason, that Fourth Amendment just never carried over into our digital lives. For some reason, the government's like, well, we're not allowed to look through all of your belongings without a warrant and all of that if it's physical, but your digital life, yeah, let's just take all of that. Let's collect all of that, rifle through it whenever we want. And if you want to protect it, we'll try and get a backdoor into it. Like, it's a complete perversion about the balance of power that we're meant to have. And I think it's so sad when people kind of have this knee-jerk response of I'm not doing anything wrong. It's like, well, that's not really what privacy is about. It's not about doing something wrong. It's about the right to selectively reveal to the world what you want to reveal. And I think that we all should have the right to make that choice, which data we want released, what information we want known about us. And if the government wants more than that, they can get a warrant.
I want to talk about some specific things that people do every day that if they did them differently, they would have better results in terms of privacy. And I'd like to start with the search engine simply because the name Google is just synonymous with lack of privacy. I mean, Google has become, even though the search engine as a tool is an astonishingly, it's just an amazing invention and extremely useful, obviously, for all of us. But the other side of the coin is that Google has become synonymous with, I wouldn't say carelessness with your data. It's not that. It's they're actively sharing that data. But let's get into the specific. What exactly does that mean? What kind of data is being captured when I do a Google search? And maybe I'm doing these Google searches partly because Google is the default search engine in my browser.
Yeah, so much information is being collected about you. Most of us live so much of our lives in the digital realm these days. And when you're browsing the internet and looking up things, this can give you a giant window into your political affiliations, your sexual preferences, the people that you meet with, you know, the fetishes that you have, the jobs that you've had, things that you feel about the government. Like, I mean, it could tell everything about you. And it's not just obvious things too. We're in the age of machine learning where data points like how long you hovered over a search result before scrolling past it actually get collected. Your mouse movements, you know, whether you're about to click things. Did you know that if you type into the Google search bar and you don't even press enter, let's say I'm like, I want to look up Tom Woods and I type in Tom Woods. And then I'm like, nah, I just delete it. Those keystrokes were already captured and sent to Google. So it doesn't matter that you didn't send it. They already had that information. And I think that people don't realize just how good Google is about taking all of these abstract data points and putting them together in a way that humans can't really find patterns in these things, but computers absolutely can because they have way more computational power. So Google is taking all these data points and really painting an incredible picture of who we all are. And I think it was the Irish Civil Liberties Association, they put out a report where they got hold of basically the database of all of the identifiers that Google uses. So like we all know that Google, you know, it's a search engine, it's a browser, but really it's an advertising company. It's the largest advertising company in the world. And what they're doing every time you load a page, there's a couple of seconds where there are some empty boxes, or maybe it's milliseconds, empty boxes on your page, and they're suddenly filled with things that are trying to capture your attention, you know, articles or things to purchase or whatever. And what's happened behind the scenes is Google has said, okay, everyone, Naomi's just opened up her browser and gone to this page. We have these boxes to fill. These are all of the things we know about her. Who wants to buy it? And so what they're essentially doing is taking everything they know about me and just blasting it to the thousands of approved buyers in their real-time bidding system. And you got to think, like, who are these people who are collecting this data? They don't even have to bid on the ad space to collect it. They can just be sitting there passively collecting this data. And those companies are not just ad companies. They're data brokers. They're government agencies. And those people are then collecting that data and passing it on to thousands more. So we have no control over whose hands this data ends up. And that's a pretty scary prospect. So I would just be really mindful of all of the ways that we're leaving digital exhaust. You know, you mentioned Google as the search engine, but there are more private alternatives. If you even wanted Google search results, you could use something like Startpage, which is a more private front end for the Google search engine. So basically, you can look at proxy sites. You don't even have to visit the real website. Your IP address isn't collected. All of these things can really add up and just really dramatically decrease the amount of data that companies like Google are collecting about you. And it's not just Google, because there are people who they think that the private and the public are so distinct. And why do I care if Google has my information? Do they just want to sell me a pair of shoes? Actually, it's a lot more insidious than that. I think a lot of people are thinking about this in a pre-internet world. And what's that world look like? Well, that was a world where private companies had very limited insight into our lives, very limited amount of data that they collected. And governments had very limited ability to collect that data too from the private companies. What is the situation now? Private companies are collecting every single thing about us, and the government has a free-for-all. There is no Fourth Amendment protecting any of this data due to things like the third-party doctrine that basically say, if you hand your data over, like if you use the infrastructure of the internet, which relies on third parties for everything, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy. So they can basically get every single thing about you. So I don't think it's as straightforward as this private-public divide, because at the end of the day, Google is collecting all this information and all these companies are collecting information, and they're basically amassing it into giant treasure troves of data that governments can subpoena, they can give national security letters, they can break into it, they can get back doors into it. You know, we learned through the Snowden revelations that there are kind of programs like PRISM programs where they're just getting direct access to the servers of a lot of these companies. So I think that we need to step away from this divide and just realize how bad the situation has gotten in the digital age, that things are so blurry that you actually do, as a conscientious citizen who wants the right to privacy, who wants the right to freedom in their life, we should really be mindful of how much data we're giving to everyone, knowing that that data is not protected at all. And there are so many ways that we can work to protect our data. As we said, Startpage is one, Brave search engine is another. There are lots of different search engines out there that you could easily just make the switch to and make a huge difference.
In your book, you told a story about something that happened that I hadn't known about, involving the person we have come to refer to as Tank Man. The person in that famous photograph from China's Tiananmen Square in 1989, where he's standing there in front of that tank. And one day, somehow he disappeared from major search engines. Can you explain what happened there and what the significance of that is?
Yeah, so search engines, we often think of it as just a privacy violation. But search engines are our porthole into the internet at large. They're in charge of indexing all of the pages, getting these little spiders that crawl over the internet and collect all the URLs and basically put them into this index that is searchable. That also means that they have control over what they can show us. And it's been shown that there is a lot of censorship of this information. And people should really be mindful that the things that they're being shown are the things that these companies want to show them. Companies like Google, Microsoft, for example. And I think it was maybe 2 years ago now, on the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. And Tank Man, that famous image that we all know, it's the day after the massacre, there are tanks rolling down the street and this anonymous man, I don't think we ever learned his real identity, just decides to stand in front of them holding grocery bags. And it's this amazing image of revolution and fighting against authoritarian control. And of course, it's banned in China. They don't want anyone to know about Tiananmen Square. They don't want anyone to know about this image. But what was very... very suspicious was in the United States, in the Western world, on the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. Suddenly, if you were to look up in a search engine such as Google and Bing and Yahoo, I think there were, I can't off the top of my head remember exactly which search engines it applied to, but there were a bunch of mainstream ones, and Bing immediately comes to mind. You wouldn't find any result about Tank Man. Now, this is an incredibly famous, famous picture. You type that into your search engine, you would get zero results. Sorry, we don't have anything. Do you want to search for something else? Which is crazy, right? So you have to think, what is going on there? What kind of other stuff are we not being shown? And how do we get around that? So I think that it was Bing came out like soon after and was like, oh no, this was a mistake. It was just a bug and it's fixed now. So it did come back online. So it wasn't like China had completely infiltrated the Western world and was able to censor. But what was, I mean, obvious from this is that they were able to force these companies to censor these things and successful. And it makes us think, what else are they censoring? What are some of the things that the US government doesn't want us to see? So the EU, what do they not want us to see? And so what we can also be mindful of is when we use search engines, finding ones where you can tweak the algorithm, like something like Brave Search, for example, allows you to set the parameters for what kind of material would you like to be shown? Would you like it to be more left-wing or right-wing? Would you like to never get any sources from PBS? Would you like to only get sources from PBS? You can set different parameters where you can affect the algorithm. And what we're getting instead for most mainstream search engines is complete opaqueness when it comes to the results. They all say, no, we're neutral and we just filter misinformation, but generally we're showing you all the things on the internet. It's just not true. We don't know what they're showing us. It's completely opaque. We have no way to verify that we're actually being shown the correct things. There are so many things that go on. And it's not just censorship. It's also like, what are we being shown first? How is this influencing people's conception of the world? They did some experiments where they tried autofilling. And it was amazing. Like, the autofill functionality was actually influencing people in certain directions. So for example, if you look up Naomi Brockwell and all you get is Naomi Brockwell is, and it also completes to a terrible person, is lazy, is ugly, is really bad, you would start to get an impression of who Naomi Brockwell is. What if you looked up Naomi Brockwell and the autofill was Naomi Brockwell is intelligent, she is the best, Naomi Brockwell is amazing, conquering the world of privacy, helping people. I mean, it can paint a completely different picture. And they did experiments, I think, in the last election where they looked up different politicians and found that they were being completely skewed in different directions. Like, certain politicians, the autofill was all good, and other politicians, it was all bad. So again, we just have to be really mindful of what's called choice architecture, where companies are really deciding what we see, and we have to be mindful of that and make sure that we are setting ourselves up for success by trying to give ourselves as much freedom as we can in learning about new information and breaking down those artificial barriers. Like, seek out the search engines that say in their policy, we're not going to filter results like that. Seek out search engines that say, we're not going to collect your data and build profiles on you. All of that is actually obtainable. And it's, I feel like it's such a worthwhile goal for people who want to be independent thinkers and make up their own minds about the world rather than having someone else's idea of the world shoved down their throat.
Well, that reminds me of something, and I guess here I'm going to be dragging you into a bit of controversy, but you may recall a little over a year ago, there was some controversy surrounding the search engine DuckDuckGo, which a lot of people concerned about privacy use, and also concerned about search engine bias use. And the controversy surrounded, I don't know what position is CEO or founder or whatever, was saying that in light of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Russian sources, or maybe just, I don't know if it was sources contrary to the narrative or what, were going to be downgraded in the DuckDuckGo search results. And people felt like, well, no matter how I feel about the invasion of Ukraine, this is exactly why I wanted to use DuckDuckGo, is so that I could make up my own mind about what sources I read. Do you think that the backlash was justified in that case?
I think it absolutely was. And that's because, I mean, there are lots of search engines out there that I know filter, and maybe I still use them with that in mind. The difference is that DuckDuckGo had two main pillars that were really enticing people to their product. One of them was privacy. The other one was no filtering of results. In fact, they were responsible for some famous articles about the filter bubble, really illuminating the problem with these filter bubbles and things like Google that only show you certain types of results. So DuckDuckGo, for them to have this pillar, and then as soon as the war started, for them to just chop it down, I think betrayed so many people. People became really disillusioned with that platform, because if that was one of their main core principles and they were willing to undermine that as soon as something came up that they thought was more important than freedom of speech and the free flow of information, it makes you really second guess what else they were doing. Since then, there have been some other controversial things. I basically stopped recommending DuckDuckGo when that happened, because there are plenty of other really great search engines that I know haven't compromised their principles. So I was really disappointed to see that. I think that individuals are smart and we should give them the benefit of the doubt and at least give them the freedom to make up their own mind. Even if they're not smart, even if they make what you think is the wrong decision, they have the right to look at all of the information available and make up their own mind. And so I was really disappointed with DuckDuckGo kind of playing the nanny there and saying, we will show this information, but we don't think you're old enough to handle this other type of information. It just is so patronizing. It's just, we're infantilizing the entire population and saying, well, we're going to make your decisions for you because you can't be trusted with your decisions. I think it's ludicrous.
Hey, everybody, quick message from our friends at CrowdHealth. If there is a sector of the American economy more screwed up than healthcare, I'd like to know what it is. Or a product that we all regularly buy that is more maddening and confusing than health insurance. I'd like to know what that is. When was the last time you heard somebody say, I'm so satisfied with my health insurance? Almost never. Premiums are increasing, deductibles are getting larger, claims denials are becoming more common. It is very, very irritating and annoying. You feel like you're being looted and taken advantage of. Well, CrowdHealth is changing the game. Now you can finally have peace of mind surrounding your healthcare. Your $50 a month membership includes the tools and services you need to get the highest quality healthcare. And I'm talking about access to telemedicine visits, discounted prescriptions, so much more, without doctors' networks messing things up. Plus, you'll have access to your own personal care advocate who will help you navigate the complexities of health events and even negotiate bills on your behalf. And of course, you'll join the crowd, a group of members just like you who want to help pay for each other's unexpected medical events. It's time you opt out of restrictive health insurance plans and let CrowdHealth help fit your healthcare needs. Get started today for just $50 per month. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/woods to get the healthcare you deserve. CrowdHealth is not insurance. Learn more at joincrowdhealth.com. That's joincrowdhealth.com/woods. Well, let's go to the web browser now after the search engine. In the same way that people think Google is a big problem, they also think Chrome's a big problem. What is the big problem with Chrome?
Well, again, Google product, and Chrome is one of the most notorious for collecting data. So Google Chrome, Edge browser, they're all really, really bad. They are capturing every single thing they can. And they're using that to feed their algorithms and to feed their databases and to target with certain content. And I would stay away from Chrome. It is an incredibly invasive tool on your phones, on your computers. Again, I use the Brave browser, and there are lots of different opinions for which browsers are best. There are some really good options out there. I personally like Brave just because out of the box, I think they provide hands down the best privacy of any of the browsers. There are lots of other browsers where you can tweak certain settings, you can harden it yourself, you can install these other things on top of it. So if you like granular control, you might look for something else. But if you're like, listen, I don't want to make the decisions, I just want something that's the most private, plug and play, Brave is a really good option. And they're the most aggressive for things like stopping bounce tracking, which is, you know, when you open a website and you'll be going to Amazon or something. But before you get there, on the bottom left of your screen, you're seeing all of the URLs. And suddenly there'll be a flash of like three or four URLs there before it takes you to the site. And you're like, oh, what just happened there? Oh, well, I guess I ended up at the site I was meant to end up at. So I guess it's fine. No, what was actually happening is, as a way to get around the third-party cookie issue, which a lot of browsers have started to block, a lot of advertising companies instead do something called bounce tracking, where they will just bounce you through a bunch of tracking sites before taking you to the destination that you want to get to. So Brave is really good at trying to block those. They try to learn which ones are the tracking sites and just bypass them completely. It's worth noting that Google Chrome is one of the few browsers, like, as I said, your third-party cookies have been stopped on almost all browsers except Chrome. Chrome keeps saying, we'll block it one day, coming down the pipeline. And then they just keep kicking the can down the road because they make a tremendous amount of money from these third-party cookies. So they're one of the few browsers that still allows third-party tracking cookies. I would just avoid Chrome entirely.
So Brave then is your recommendation?
I like Brave, but people are going to have personalized opinions for that. Some people like Firefox, but only if you like harden it, tweak the settings to your personal recommendation. There's a browser for Android called Vanadium, which is a really good private browser. There are a lot of different browsers out there. Even Safari is going to be much better than Chrome, but Brave, I think, is hands down the most private by default.
All right. Now let's talk about something that's a bit more technical, the VPN. And let's talk about the good and the bad on that. Now, the only time I've ever used a VPN is for the most trivial of reasons. We were in St. Lucia and we wanted to watch The Simpsons. And for some reason, you couldn't watch it in St. Lucia. They hadn't banned The Simpsons, but we couldn't get Disney Plus or something. However it was that The Simpsons was conveyed to somebody. And I'm sorry, I don't care. Whoever is going to get me The Simpsons, I'm going to get it from them. And so we used the VPN and then we were watching The Simpsons. But I'm sure there are more substantial reasons somebody might have for using a VPN. So what would those be and what should we be looking out for when choosing one?
Yeah, so VPNs are great for obfuscating your IP address. And the use case that you pointed out is, well, sometimes there are geo-blockers for certain geographical areas for certain types of content. Sometimes Hulu shows you different content if you're watching in Japan versus Australia. And so people can hide their IP address and make it seem like they're coming from a different place so they can actually get access. But hiding the IP address is the crucial part because every website that you visit gets to see your IP address. That means that every place that you've purchased something, every place where you've clicked on a link, someone's blog, all of this stuff, they have the ability to see your IP address. Now, what is your IP address? Well, it roughly maps to your location. It means that you're showing everyone you interact with on the internet exactly where you are. So that's a really, really huge deal. And you should definitely block that. Not only is that like just letting people know your location, but if you repeatedly go to certain websites, well, they can start to build up profiles of you and patterns of your usage. And so it's a way to kind of track your behavior just by revealing this very personal identifier. So I think that people should use a VPN for every single thing that they're doing, simply as a tool for masking their IP address from whoever they're interacting with. There are some people who say, well, a VPN is great for doing bad things because it hides your activity. Actually, that's not true because the VPN company sees your activity. So this isn't a tool where you can get away with doing all kinds of stuff. You need to trust the VPN company to keep your data safe. And knowing that they're collecting it all, it's basically saying, instead of me trusting 1,000 different websites I visit in a week with my IP address, let me just trust one company and then I know it's going to be spread to less people. You know, it's going to end up in less databases about me. So there's that. On the other side of things, you also have bad VPN companies. So it's a really important decision to choose a company that is reputable, that has a track record, where you know who the developers are, where you kind of have insight into the project. So if you just look up VPN apps on your phone or like VPN extensions, you can bet that the vast majority of the VPNs that pop up are actually just data collection tools, unfortunately. And I don't want to scare people off because I just told everyone they should use a VPN. But they need to be really careful which VPN, because so many companies will say, hey, yeah, I'd love to get access to all of your data and see every website you're visiting. And so there are so many just shells of VPNs out there that, yeah, sure, they may be giving you a different IP address, but they're also collecting everything you're doing and selling it. And it's really hard to tell the good from the bad. So there are basically, I mean, really, there's probably only two VPNs that I know enough about that I'm comfortable recommending them. One of them is Proton VPN, which I really like. They're based in Switzerland, which has really strict laws around data collection, especially VPN laws. So I really like that they're curtailed by that. And the other one is Molvad, which is this open source VPN that is really well vetted and very highly recommended in the security community. Sometimes you just got to look at the people who are obsessed with this stuff, who are betting the code, who are really into it. And if the majority of them are like, yeah, this is the cool tool, you know, if you don't have the expertise, you have, I mean, there is an element of trust needed in everything. So I've come to the conclusion that those are the two that I'm comfortable in my life. Perhaps in your research, you might come to a different conclusion. I think that's fine. But the main thing is just be discerning before you just jump into a product. Just do the research, ask questions, go to forums and find out what people are saying, because you shouldn't just dive in and use any VPN.
Well, last thing, you mentioned Proton VPN, and that is a product of the same company that is behind Proton Mail for email. So can you explain why so many of my friends use Proton Mail for their email?
Yes, because it is one of the most private email providers. Email is an inherently insecure protocol. When it was first developed, no one really had privacy in mind. Everything sent in the clear. Afterwards, as we started to realize that this became a staple for communicating on the internet, instead of overhauling the system, we've just kind of put all these band-aids on top. So it's still this janky, bad system. But that doesn't mean that we should throw it out completely. There are more private ways to use it. So Proton Mail is really interesting because they offer different levels of encryption. Now, encryption, it's basically the digital version of a lock and key. It keeps things secure. So let's go through the different types of encryption. First of all, let's talk about end-to-end encryption, which is, I think, the most important. When you have end-to-end encryption, that means that only the sender and recipient of something can access the data. So if I send an end-to-end encrypted email to someone, let's say I sent one to you, only you and I can access it. Proton Mail cannot access it. Now, the caveat here is that we have to be within the same network to make it end-to-end encrypted, because our different accounts need to know how to exchange those keys and communicate privately, create that encrypted tunnel between us. So we have to use the same system. So Proton Mail offers end-to-end encryption between users. This is like definitely not the case with something like Yahoo or Gmail. Those companies are looking at all of your emails. They are sifting through it. There were scandals a couple of years ago where Google was found to just be giving that information from your private emails to third parties so that they could use it how they want. Like, it's crazy. If you consider emails at all private, you should be trying to find ways to lock it down. So end-to-end encryption is one of them. I like Proton Mail because of the network effect. So I know there are a lot of people with a Proton Mail email, which means that when I send out a Proton Mail email and I send it to someone else who also has Proton Mail, that email is end-to-end encrypted. Great. There's also the option, if I send an email from my Proton account to someone with Gmail, I can actually opt to password protect it. It's kind of another form of this end-to-end encryption that locks it down, but it allows you to basically cross over that barrier and use a different network. So you can do password protected emails. You can also use something called PGP that gets pretty technically dense, but you can use that out of network as well. So that's one kind of encryption that they offer. The next, which I think is super important, is zero access encryption. So let's say that I have an unencrypted email with someone. And let's say someone from Gmail sends me an email and then that just sits in my inbox. And it wasn't end-to-end encrypted because they're from Gmail, I'm from Proton Mail. And so it's sitting there. So generally, companies will keep this kind of data just sitting there. And if they're a really bad company, they'll have it sitting there in the clear, which means that any hacker that gets into that database is going to be able to access that. And you see leaks all the time where someone will be like, oh, this entire treasure trove of private communications was leaked onto the internet because a hacker broke into this database and revealed the contents of everything that everyone did. And so that's one type of encryption, one type of way to store these emails. Now, there's another one called encrypted at rest. Now, that means that if a hacker tried to break into this database, they wouldn't be able to because the company has taken those emails in its treasure trove and they've encrypted them, and it at least protects it from hackers. So Proton Mail does that, but then they go a step further and they say, we're going to add zero access encryption. When we get emails, yes, technically there's a split second where we could read them before we encrypt them. But then we're going to encrypt them with your private key so that we no longer can get any access to them. So not only if a hacker breaks into the database, they can't get them, but also if we're subpoenaed, we can't actually give anyone the contents of your email. And this has been proven multiple times in court where governments have said, I need the contents of this email. And they said, sorry, we actually have zero access to it. So Proton Mail is very popular for people who really value privacy for these reasons. It's also super intuitive to use. There are other private email providers out there as well. TutorNotary is a really great option. I like Proton Mail. I use both, but I like Proton Mail because of the network effect. I just really like knowing that there's more chance my email is going to be end-to-end encrypted if I send it out.
Well, I'm of course recommending your beginner's introduction to privacy. People should read that. I've got that linked at tomwoods.com/2342. But do you have any other links where people can follow you?
Yeah, so we put out free tutorials on our YouTube channel. You can watch everything on our YouTube channel, also on our library channel, which is going to be a far more private way to watch it. We also upload everything to BitChute. We also upload it to minds.com. So you can find our long form content, which are 10 to 20 minute tutorials where we dive into each of these topics. You can find that if you look up Naomi Brockwell TV or MBTV, and you'll find our content. And then we also do like fun short videos also on Library or Odyssey if you wanted to use the website. And we're also on TikTok and Instagram. Our main thing is getting to the mainstream and teaching them that this doesn't have to be the norm. They can learn about privacy and how to reclaim their digital sovereignty. So we're on all of the platforms and we have alternatives. We have options there if you want to find ways to watch us more privately. You absolutely can. We're on a whole bunch of more private platforms and decentralized platforms as well.
Well, one of the implicit points being made in your beginner's introduction to privacy is that you do not have to be some kind of tech whiz to secure your privacy online. That's absolutely not the case. Not only do you explain the concepts very clearly for the layman, but you also just give alternatives that are very user-friendly. I mean, you can use the Brave browser, for example, with no problem at all. So it really is just a matter of if this really is something that you value, it's not difficult to make it a reality in your life. So thank you, Naomi, once again, for it's always great talking to you for the time today, but also for this important work that you're doing.
Well, thank you so much. I hope that people are inspired to change the future. I really hope that we can change the norms and set up a more private world for future generations.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.